I'm going to have to pass.
You can't.
Why don't you pay some chick to marry you, if you need to set this up?
Some chick, like who?
Give me the phone. I know plenty of chicks who could use the cash. What do you want, a blonde? A Puerto Rican? I'll get you a heavy girl. She'll make you feel better about yourself.
Hey, it doesn't matter. I don't have any extra cash. Look, man, you're the only person I can trust.
Hey, you know who you can trust? Your maid, Teresa.
She steals.
She steals? Why don't you fire her?
I'm afraid. I think she's into voodoo. I don't know.
Oh, God.
Look, this is the only way I can keep doing what I do and make sure my kids are protected.
Larry, look at us. We're not gay. But if we were gay, don't you think I'd be with someone a little hotter looking than you? I'm Mr. February, for God's sakes. It'd be like the prom king fooling around with a tuba player.
Great. I play tuba.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm one of your hosts and curators, Devin Decker, and joining me in this adventure into the thrilling world of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, my curator et al., Sejun Serowik. Sejun?
Yes, thank you, Devin. And this is going to be a thrilling night, more thrilling than most, actually, I think.
I agree. I am all a Twitter at what we are here to do today on this latest episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, because this is season 3, baby!
Woo, woo! And yeah, man, we made it this far. That means we ain't going nowhere.
Yeah, that's what they say. They say if you make it to the third season, you ain't going nowhere. Unless NBC offers you $1 million an episode and you decide, nah, I'm good.
Or a Netflix exec gets a hold of your script. But yeah, what's going on, everybody?
What is going on? Welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Season 3. And you know what they say, in podcasting, you either live long enough to die a hero or see yourself become the villain. And that is why with Season 3 of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we're exploring a different side of the man that we worship, you know, in a respectable sort of way, every month on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, you know, as famously in all trilogies, the dark third chapter, you know, Return of the Jedi, Spider-Man Far From Home.
Spider-Man Far From Home is the second movie, or I guess if you count Civil War, you know what? We're not here to talk about any of those movies.
I was talking about it as a third act to Endgame, but
that's a really good point. This guy is on a different level. I mean, I'd want to talk about Eternals, to be completely honest. It covers the homosexual romance and all of that, but we're not the Say Report tonight. Tonight, I have on my tie, and I am here to talk about the films of Adam Sandler and the potential for a shared cinematic universe within them. But if we're going to look at over 25 years of cinema, eventually we're going to have to gaze into those deep, dark pits. We're going to have to spend some time with those films that could be considered villains in the oeuvre of Adam Sandler.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important that we establish up front here in the first episode of the third season, villains, that we kind of dive into what that word is going to mean for us here. So no, this is not that Adam Sandler plays the bad guy in the movie. Kind of hard to find actually that type of role from him. I'd be very interested in that. So like, look forward to that one day. But yeah, we decided that we wanted to start taking a look at some of the movies that were a little bit more villainous in terms of like his career. Maybe the movies that didn't hit the way that they were intended to, maybe the kind of movies that hit just the way they were intended to, and he was off the mark. We'll talk about that. And like, you know, the idea that like these are the movies that these are the reason people cringe when they talk about Adam Sandler, as opposed to the last two seasons where we've done a lot of very much like celebrating like the stuff that people tend to forget about Adam Sandler. Like, we'd be remiss if we just ignored all the bad parts, right? And that's what we intend to do these next few episodes.
Exactly. And after all the positivity that we did generate in the first two seasons, we thought, now's the time to go that little bit negative. Not necessarily in how we're approaching them. We're still going to be approaching these films from that serious point. We're going to try to be respectful while discussing them. But it's time that we look at the ones that not everybody loves. The ones that when I'm talking to people and saying I do an Adam Sandler podcast, they say, you know what Adam Sandler movie I fucking hate? And I go, no, I'd love to hear it. I'm just going to jot it down for no reason. Well, everybody I lied to at my cousin's bat mitzvah, this is the reason. And shalom for listening.
Man, I am... there's so much to unpack in that opening alone, Dev.
Well, you know, it's an Adam Sandler show, right? Anywho, so where we're starting, the first film, as announced at the end of Eight Crazy Nights, is with a little film from 2007 called I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. And this film is significant for a couple of reasons, one of which will be revealed in the season 6 premiere of The Say Report. But of all the Adam Sandler films that we've covered so far, this is the first one that Seijin and I saw together for the first time in a movie theater.
Yeah, yeah. We this 2007 was the year that we had started really kind of digging our heels in and going to movies a lot. That meant going to movies together a lot because we were the only two out of our fucking minds enough to do it. But yeah, this ended up being the first. This is the first chance for an Adam Sandler excursion together, and we took it.
Oh, we took it hardcore. We took it to the point that this was one of those weeks that we were able to convince people to join us our excursion. But we're theater kids, so we kind of bait and switched them, and we did a double feature with Hairspray.
Came out the same day, yeah.
Yeah, and loving my double header, double features to have a theme, it was, you know, relationships between two people of the same gender. Because if you remember from Hairspray, John Travolta plays the mother who's married to Christopher Walken. So it made for one cracker of a doubleheader. And we'll talk more about our experience with Hairspray on The Say Report. But here we are on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe talking about a film that Seijin and I first experienced together. And that feels cool to me.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm happy we can finally do something like this, because the other thing is this is also at a point in Adam Sandler's career where a lot of things start to go downhill, and it's not a guarantee going forward that Seijin's going to go out of his way to go see an Adam Sandler movie in the old theater. So not only was it our first chance, it was very nearly probably our last chance.
And when we get to talking about the film proper, I think you'll understand why. But before we get to the film proper, let's give a little, you know, recap on why we're here, what the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast is all about. Really, we're here to establish our own personal star chart of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe. That means this is not the definitive one. This is not the one that one day will be emblazoned upon Wikipedia as the end-all be-all of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. No, this is two guys who love pop culture, who love the films of Adam Sandler, sitting down, watching them, applying their own curated list of rules as to what does and doesn't make a film eligible for the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, and then applying them to the entire body of work. Did I miss anything,
Boom.
Seijin?
No, that's there it is. That's the plan, folks. And if you haven't listened to the last couple of seasons, I encourage you to, because we've had some doozies already. But tonight is going to be something special, I think, because I think, normally this is the part of the show where we talk about some first impressions, right? And I have to say that, like, I almost think my first impression was stronger than my most recent viewing of it. This movie ages weirdly. I'm not going to say that it gets worse with time, because I strongly believe that even at the time it was seen as having a lot of issues. And we'll get more into like the plot in a second when Devin does his breakdown. But pretty, pretty obviously pretty straightforward that, like, this was going to rub some people the wrong way. Were those people going to necessarily be Seijin at that age in 2007? Well, what was I, 17, 16?
No, you were 20, maybe 20? 19. Because I was 21. Not, so yeah. 2007 was also the year I turned 21. 15 years ago. Think about it, Seijin.
Oh, man. So, yeah, so I would have been, like, 19, right? So, yeah, and I don't know. I like to think that I was smart enough to pick up on the fact that a lot of the problematic stuff in this a lot of stuff in this movie is problematic. I know that I didn't walk away from this movie thinking it was my favorite Adam Sandler movie or actually ever really thinking about it much too often after that. You know what I mean? Like it's not a movie that left an impression on me. So as far as first impressions go, I don't know what I can say. But watching it this afternoon, I remember now that there are bits in this movie that are like pretty classic, like great comedy bits. Like for all of the problems that this movie has when it's like being terrible, there are some moments in this movie that are legitimately like endearing. And I think that's due to a lot of what was going on behind the scenes, both between Adam Sandler and Kevin James in this movie, because no matter what, you cannot deny that their friendship on screen is watchable, right? Like, and but also the behind the scenes on like who's behind this movie, and we have a section dedicated to that too, but like all of that comes together to make a movie that really did have a fair shot at being something really important. I just don't know if Adam Sandler was maybe the right vehicle for that message.
Seijin hit the nail on the head for me. One thing about the Adam Sandler cinematic universe is we wear ties whenever we're recording this show because we want to add that air of class to the proceedings. Well, underneath my tie this week, I have a neck brace on because the tonal whiplash in I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry is real.
Yeah.
This film will do whatever it wants for the joke, and then suddenly, from out of fucking nowhere, it will come at you with something that is deep, heavy, relevant, meaningful, and you're left wondering, what was the number of that truck that hit me?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is not the first time we've run into this feeling that it feels like the movie of I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, whatever the movie was, that then got, some may say bastardized, others may just say, you know, cleaned up for consumption by Adam Sandler and his crew. Like, it's those moments you can feel that there's something underneath it that maybe came from somewhere other than Adam Sandler, right?
Right. And I mean, hopefully I'm not going too out of bounds with this conversation. I think a big part of it is that the original finished first draft of this script emerged around 2003. So yeah. It was written in a very different climate, definitely influenced from the gay panic in cinema and entertainment of the late 90s. And I think a lot of that is present in this script. But then by the time you get to 2007 and things have progressed, not as far as they needed to or as far as they have now in 2022, but progressed enough that the gay panic stuff, it's there, it's relatable enough, but there's some important storytelling elements that we need to try to put into this film.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a hard film to talk about, folks. Strap in. like plain and simple. It was not an easy one to watch and not an easy one for us to talk about because, it's undeniable that there is definitely some stuff in this movie that didn't age well, didn't start off well, didn't ever come from the right place. And then, you know, there's the weird stuff that does and did. And, it sneaks up on you because it's clearly not enough to save this movie in any meaningful way. So when it does show up, it is jarring.
Yeah. I will say, after everything, I still feel pretty secure in our decision to kick off our season of Adam Sandler villain films with this movie.
Oh, yeah. It's a perfect example. because it's almost not meaning to be as hurtful as it is. And that's like the worst kind of villain, right? The most relatable villain is always the one that hits the deepest, right? Like for sure. No, I'm with you that this one needed to be here. Because of how complicated it is, I think it's going to make it, it's going to, you know, the first cut is the deepest.
Baby, as, I know.
As they say.
as many people have performed in songs. Yeah. Do you have any facts and figures for us, Sijin, on this one?
Yeah. So for all of our sitting here and talking about how it probably didn't sit well back in 2007, it sure did fine financially. So we're talking about a movie that gets an $85 million budget, which for a comedy in the mid-2000s, that was a lot, to be sure. But it was not unheard of for this kind of thing, right? Like, if they got 3 good weekends in theaters and then we're able to make an HBO deal, like, you can make back $80 million easy. And so that's, it's a safe bet, shall we say. Well, it was a super safe bet because then it goes on to make $187 million worldwide.
Yeah.
So, like, it makes its money back and then some. Domestically alone, it makes its money back with $120 million. So, like it does okay. You know, critically, it doesn't. It's, like, it's still sitting at, like, a 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, and that number will never change because that's the critic rating. And fan rating, it's not doing much better either. We're in the 60s and 70s, depending on what day you check it. But there's a... there's definitely a sense that it was the kind of movie that did well, but it really is in that era of, like, you just went to it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, the new Coen Brothers movie is coming out, let's just go to it. Oh, the new Adam Sandler movie's out, let's just go to it. Like it's that he is firmly kind of, like, resting on his laurels when it comes to, like, bringing people into the theater. And he cannot keep that up. And we see that in the next few years, that just the mere fact that Adam Sandler's putting a movie out is not enough to sell a ticket. But this movie reeks of exactly that, right?
Yeah, I mean, this, you also need to understand the time cinematically where comedy was having this weird renaissance in the wake of basically Anchorman. I would attribute the start of it to Anchorman, but then when something like The 40-Year-Old Virgin hit,
and we realized exactly
Judd Apatow had come to play making feature-length films, and we realized that giving a comedy a bigger budget tended to mean bigger returns. Mm-hmm. And that's why something like hearing that I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry had an $85 million budget doesn't really make me blush the way it would in 2022. Because if a comedy's getting made today, it's probably going to have a $20 million budget if it's lucky.
Yeah. Just in terms of other comedies that are out at the time, right? Like, so we mentioned Knocked Up. That is still in theaters. Hairspray comes out the same day, if you want to call that, like, a comedy.
The Hollywood Foreign Press would consider them competing, right?
Yeah.
A musical and a comedy.
Right. But this is also around the same time where you have License to Wed out. If you're just looking for other comedies, like, so it's Evan Almighty. I should give that a shout out as I'm looking at this list. But, like, it's weird because it's not the time where every comedy is a banger, right? Like, because there is kind of a golden age of that when you get towards, like, The Hangover and stuff like that, where it feels like there's movies coming out every month that are just, like, good to, you know. But there's a couple worth, like, noting. I mean, like, as we mentioned, Judd Apatow coming in the room, like, Knocked Up is currently in what I believe is its, like, seventh or eighth month in theaters and, like, still going strong. Like, it's still making enough money to be on, Box Office Mojo's, like, top 50 list. Like, it's weird. The atmosphere is kind of a bland one for me. Like, I gotta be honest.
I mean, some other movies that we saw this same summer that we saw in Non-Pronounce Chuck and Larry, Rise of the Silver Surfer, Fantastic Four, Ocean's 13.
Yeah.
It was a lot of sequels. Yep. Sequels dominated the box office in 2007.
Spider-Man 3. Fuck,
so,
man.
So
yes,
anything that was unique or its own sort of, like, world, not part of a franchise, was kind of this huge breath of fresh air. And you almost went to get a gasp of air before going back into the sequel smorgasbord.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Like going to see I've Now Pronounced You Chuck and Larry was kind of like was one of the benefits of going to it is at least it was a new original story, you know.
Right, exactly.
Even though you were probably getting the same old jokes you always got, it still at least felt new, right?
Yeah. And I mean, well, we'll get to what I think is really interesting about this film eventually. I think when we get to New Old Borrowed Blue, we'll touch on something that is interesting to me about this particular film we're looking at in the ASCU.
Yeah, the only other thing worth mentioning is just because we already touched on it, the idea that this movie is so jarring and it was written earlier and then suddenly it comes out 4 years later with Adam Sandler and crew attached is it is originally written by Barry Finero. Like, I think I'm saying the name right, but who he is he's a producer and writer from the Golden Girls, right? So like that is the kind of writing coming to this. The other thing is it ends up getting a punch up treatment by fucking Alexander Payne and Jim Taylor, who had just come off of doing like Sideways and stuff. And I mean, Alexander Payne goes on to do like Nebraska and things like that, like Descendants, right? So the writing on the initial version of this story, whatever it was once it was put on screen, like it was clearly worked from that. But the original version of this is written by this, like these heavy hitters of not just comedy, not just kind of like biting kind of cynical comedy, but also like statement comedy, political comedy, for lack of a better word. Like, and this is a political comedy, right? Like, I mean, it's social politics to be sure, with a little bit of the government stuff thrown in for flavor. But like, the main point of this whole movie is the ways in which society is viewing homosexuality at this time. And so, like, knowing the background on the writers there, it makes total sense what this movie was, quote unquote, supposed to be, right?
I agree. And it's weird that that's still in the DNA of the final feature that we get.
Yeah.
But weirdly, those parts that are still in the DNA feel almost like the ones that are the most out of time and not with what is actually going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
In 2007.
Well, it's one of those things where it's because the politics of what they're talking about are pretty timeless. Just because the legality of gay marriage has come to pass in the last decade here, that doesn't mean that there's not groups of people out there that still oppose it and still do what they can to get, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like it didn't just flip a switch. So I think that that's what you're feeling, is the idea that like that this movie has that kind of acknowledgement that this is an issue that is timeless, but the specific events of which we see in this film really do make it feel like a switch just gets flipped in somebody and suddenly they're okay with things. Yeah. Which is upsettingly not how the world works, unfortunately. You know what I mean? Like I wish it were that easy. But the other thing is that's really interesting to me about the writing team behind it is that some of the more pandery saccharine moments and some of the more goofy pandering comedy moments are maybe not necessarily in Sandler's hands. And I say Sandler and I mean the team, right? Like, yeah. like his whole creative team.
Happy Madison Productions.
Like, yeah. A lot of that stuff is present in things like Golden Girls and Descendants and all of that sort of stuff. Like you see like weird moments of physical shtick that stick out like a sore thumb because of the way the rest of the film, like that's in their writing as well. So in a weird way, there's moments that happen in this movie that feel like they're tugging at your heartstrings and it's not fair. And it's easy to point your finger at somebody like Sandler and his team and say like, you guys are taking the easy way out on this. But that was probably in this script, but even before they got a hold of it, right? It's some of the dumber stuff, some of the dumber conversations, some of the language, some of the jokes that are spoken. That is all from Sandler and his crew.
I don't know. But so that means that, I mean, one of the biggest issues I have with this film is the plot. The actual inciting incident of this film really bothers me. But before I get to that any deeper, I should probably rock this synopsis, right?
I mean, right. Let's let the people know what the plot is, because for anybody that hasn't seen it, and I think we've made it clear by now, we don't blame you if you didn't.
Yeah, certainly. If you didn't go see this movie, no one's upset with you. Good morning, Baltimore. Good morning, Baltimore. Lawrence Valentine has a problem. His New York Fire Department pension should have had the beneficiary switch from his wife Paula to his children 3 years ago when she passed away. But he missed the window, and now if he were to die in the line of duty, his family will be left with nothing. While his attempt to appeal the decision of the pension board ends in failure, due to the time to do so having elapsed, he leaves with an idea percolating in his mind, planted there by a single female caseworker. If he were to get married, then he would be able to name his spouse as the new beneficiary. Still distracted by the situation, Lawrence joins fellow firefighter Charles Levine on shift and laments his situation as they do a secondary search following a warehouse fire. When Charles's life is put in jeopardy by some falling debris, Lawrence leaps into action and saves him, landing both men in the hospital. When they awaken, Charles tells Lawrence that based on the code of the firefighters, he owes him for saving his life. Whatever he wants, whenever he wants. That night, lamenting his situation, Lawrence sees an article in the newspaper that gives him the perfect idea on how Charles can pay him back. He and Charles are going to become domestic partners. At first, it seems like everything will be fine. Nothing more than filing some paperwork at City Hall and Charles having his mail forwarded to Lawrence's house for a few months. But things get complicated when the pension department sends out an investigator to follow up on their filing to confirm it isn't one of those situations where people abuse the homosexual lifestyle to reap illegal benefits. Spooked by the initial interview, Lawrence and Charles seek the counsel of Alex McDonough, a lawyer who tells them the best thing to do is pop up to Canada to legitimize their domestic partnership by getting married. One quick trip to Niagara Falls later, and Mickey Rooney from Breakfast at Tiffany's pronounces them as Chuck and Larry. Getting married was the right choice, as their case has been assigned to Clint Fitzer, who turns the whole affair into a weird gay witch hunt, hoping to prove that Chuck and Larry are simply two heterosexual men aiming to defraud the city. To complicate matters further, the investigation and media coverage of some of their extracurricular activities ouch Chuck and Larry to their firehouse, and immediately their fellow crewmen show their ignorance and homophobia. After weeks of walking in the shoes of a gay man in the late 2000s, Chuck and Larry have learned a lesson about intolerance, and while they are ultimately found guilty when their captain confesses he knew it was all a ruse, the gay community embraces them as icons for proving love can exist in many different forms. And as a settlement, they develop a plan that will be mutually beneficial to all involved.
All right, all right. There you have it, folks. It's that easy. You're not wrong in pointing out that there is some issues in the plot of this story. Like, the inciting incidents seem weird, the choices that get made. And I think that that is because this movie never proposes for a second that either of them could actually possibly be anything other than straight.
I could make an argument for Chuck maybe having some bisexual tendencies, or at least interests in things that people would look at and say, well, maybe he's a little homosexual with how he embraces Eric's love of musicals, and and it's not just his love of the of Eric's love of musicals. It's more the explanation and the way that he writes it off that Frank Sinatra sang. Frank Sinatra tap danced, so maybe Chuck's whole exterior, like, portrayal, his huge machismo, is a defense mechanism because the things that he was interested in as a child made people think that he was a little queer. And I mean, that's me giving this movie a lot more credit than this film is probably owed, but it's definitely something that spoke to me in watching this film. The way that Chuck approaches things, I'm sorry,
but they go out of their way to reassure you time and time again that that's just simply not the case, because you could say the same thing about like Barry. Whoa, my God, what is his name? How I Met Your Mother.
Barney,
thank you. but you could say the same thing again about Barney, that there are certain things that he is willing to go, certain places he's willing to experiment. But at the end of the day, that show consistently reassures you that despite that, he is still straight, right? And that is the thing, is that even with all of that, I don't for a second think that about him. You know what I mean? Like, he's confident enough in his own sexuality that he is okay expressing himself in other ways, and that is kind of what elevates him in this movie above some of the other guys in the firehouse, for sure, because let's face it, they're all a bunch of dude bros. He just happens to be a particularly woke dude bro at this moment. Like, that is his character type. right? And so there's a straight up discussion in this movie. We did a reading of it at the beginning of the show, in which they express the idea that, like, look, no matter what happens going forward, we all understand that these two characters are straight white men, right? And the audience just goes along and agrees. And by the end of the movie, that never changes. You know what I mean? So like this movie never wants you to believe that. And I think that that's to the detriment of those moments in the script, because if there was a chance that they were acknowledging the idea that nobody is truly completely 100% straight, there is always that idea that there needs to be some form of exploration. Even if the determination you come into at the end is that you're straight, you're still like, you don't like, how do you know that if you're not opening yourself up to the possibility of other things, experiencing them or not, but at least opening yourself up to the possibility. And then when you get to whatever your line is, you recognize that's my line, and that's your identity, not the one that you've told yourself is, that you've never tested. Like, and that is something that is been huge in the last 20 years in the ways in which people have talked about gender and sexuality. You know, it started with around this time with things like the metrosexual nonsense and all that, but like, we've evolved to the point where like, there are guys out there that express themselves in ways that are not traditional male ways of expressing themselves, but they still identify as straight. They just happen to do these things. They happen to paint their nails, for instance, or they happen to wear outfits that are maybe not necessarily male outfits, quote unquote. So like, I think that this, if they had allowed that conversation to happen, for him to come to the conclusion that maybe I'm not completely straight, I definitely prefer the company of women, but maybe there is something more to this, I'd be so on board with you. But they never let him acknowledge that. So therefore, I can't assume that about him.
And there's so much opportunity for it, too.
Yeah.
Which is the strangest thing, because, A, thinking about it as you spoke on it, all of that stuff that I cited, and I didn't even cite the fact that Chuck can cook. Like, one of the big things is that if I'm going to be living here, I'm going to be making food for us, because you're cooking TV dinners in the oven, which would melt the plastic. Don't ask me how I know. I just happen to know. And it really is just to support that narrative that everybody who runs into them in the world is convinced that Chuck would be the wife in their relationship.
Yeah, it's all for the bit.
It's all for that bit. So it's not more than that. But the fact that Chuck, by his own admission, is the town whore, like, that means that he'd be looking to get his rocks off really wherever he could. And, you know, any port in a storm for some whores, right? I've been a fan of people who would self-identify as whores, and I'm very aware of the bisexual nature of what that meant for them.
Yeah, you know, the open sexuality of his character in 2022 has so much more potential than it did in 2007. And so, like, in a weird way, it feels like this movie comes way too early. Like, I would be really interested in this conversation in 2020 and seeing this kind of idea, right? Like, one of the things that really kind of hit me is I'm watching this movie and it's post 9/11 and all this. That's part of the reason why, like you mentioned that they're firefighters. What you didn't lean into is the idea that that is like, that's the hook of this movie, hook and ladder, if as you will. like that is, like, for me, that is the thing that sticks out in my mind. It's not just the movie where it's about gay marriage. Also, it's the one that's about firefighters, right? Much in the same way that, like you could talk about Happy Gilmore being a movie that's just about golf, but also, like, one of the best things about that is talking about, like, Happy's relationship with his grandmother. Like, that is the other part of that movie that sticks out. So, like, the love that this movie wants to show for firefighters is evident. Right. Yeah.
And I think that's actually one of the detriments of me watching the film the way that I do before I put together our synopsis, because in enveloping myself in the world of I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry for as long as I have, I see how really non-consequential the fact that they're firefighters truly is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like, it becomes sort of just set dressing for what I would determine as the story of the film. It's an interesting thing to examine.
The ways in which it plays in the first 30 minutes of the movie is really important. Like, the accident that occurs and the two of them going to the hospital and all that, that I think in defter hands would have led more to the realization of, like, Larry saying, Chuck, you're the one that I need to do this with. It can't be a woman. Because, like, there is this idea of, if he's going to fake it with a guy, why not go out and fake it with a female character if that's going to make it easier on this level and, like, not risk this, like, fraud claim that we're now learned about. But after all that, the ways in which he is treated as a firefighter post 9/11 who lost his wife and in his, like, grief never got around to filing paperwork, like, I the whole time I'm like, this is ridiculous. There would be somebody to help him, right? But in 2022, as we now sit in a world in which friggin' we had to watch John Stewart spend a good decade of his life going to bat for 9/11 responders just to get health care from Mitch McConnell, I believe that they would fuck him over like this, you know what I mean? So there's some elements in this movie that I'm just like, this ring a little bit more true now than it did even then.
The problem that I have with it, and this is the stuff that feels like it comes from a time before. It comes from, you know, what was going on at the time where this was initially written. And actually, knowing that it was finished in 2003, I wouldn't be surprised if the original script had his wife passing away in 9/11. And that being why he was so distracted by it. Mm-hmm. And couldn't deal with it. So then, like, even just 6 years removed, that little bit is left out, especially if you're going to do an Adam Sandler comedy, because, like, it's one thing to have, like, a dead wife in your Adam Sandler comedy. It's a whole other ballgame if that dead wife passed away in 9/11. Which
we see that in an Adam Sandler movie eventually, actually. Yeah. I don't mean to laugh at that. It's interesting that you say that, because we get Rain Over Me. Was it before this, maybe?
Rain Over Me was before this. So yeah, I think that's probably why they took their red pen and they scratched that right out. Yeah. But looking at it, and one of the weirdest things is I live with a man who was in the insurance business for 45 years of his life. So I go to him and I'm like, Dad, can you answer questions for me about pensions and how pensions work? And he's like, I'd love to. And it's one of these bonding moments between me and my father because of the ASCU podcast. And it's fantastic. And I say to him, would there be, like, a time limit or statute of limitations on changing your beneficiary? And he's like, well, no, it can happen any time. But if the person whose pension it is dies, you're out of luck. You should have changed who the money was going to beforehand. And I'm like, that's not the case. The wife passed away. Oh, yeah, he could change it at any time. Like, you don't, there's no, like, time limit before you get to change who your beneficiary is if you're alive and it's your pension. And I'm like, thanks, Dad, because that was something that really bothered me about this film.
Well, we're 2007, right?
Yeah.
Imagine if this was done 2 years later after the financial crisis. Then it would have been your pension's gone. Like, and then it becomes a whole other conversation.
Well, it becomes a different movie where they're becoming domestic partners to actually get the benefits that everybody is accusing them of trying to steal by lying about being married. And that's another big issue that I have with this film is the fact that they're not married. They enter into a domestic partnership, and one whole afternoon spent researching what it means to be domestic partners. Chuck and Larry are domestic partners. Mm-hmm. They're just people who live together and share a domestic space. So it would be this situation where, like, Chuck is already kind of a guardian to these kids whenever his father's not available. So we just need to fill out this paperwork with City Hall in order to make it so he can pick them up from school, or he has, like, the legal say if the father's not around. It's the real villain of this movie is Alex McDonough for telling them to go up to Canada and get married to legitimize their domestic partnership. and I hate that. I hate it because it's been eating away at the back of my mind that I'm like, they're domestic partners. The fact that they become domestic partners makes perfect sense, totally isn't fraud. What becomes fraud is when they decide, well, we're going to present as a gay married couple.
Yeah. So the reason that I think that all of this happens, despite the fact that what you're saying is 100% correct, is the idea that for what this movie is trying to do, for what this movie is trying to say, and for what this movie is trying to be, they are tapping into a lot of the huge misunderstandings the public has about this stuff, right? And it starts with the idea of homosexuality, but it grows into the idea of all of the legal nonsense that comes along with legalizing marriage, because it is a bunch of red tape bullshit. Like, you love a person, you live with that person for the rest of your life, guess what, you're married. Like, you're right? And that's what domestic partnerships are supposed to solve, is that idea that, like, you don't need to be going through a bunch of legal hullabaloo just to make sure that the person that deserves all of your shit gets all of your shit when you die. Like, so the question becomes, are they playing off of their audience's ignorance of all of this stuff and using it to their advantage, or are they pointing to it and we sit here and talk about how it's ridiculous because that's not how it works, but by doing that, we are educating each other and the world about that, right? Like, so are they trying to spark that conversation, or are they trying to just lean into it for laughs and cash, right? And I mean, I think we all know the answer to that question, and that is why this movie, I think, sits so firmly in the villain camp, is because it is not taking its opportunity to talk to an audience that otherwise doesn't have these kinds of conversations. It's not doing that. And you don't get to make a politically charged comedy and then just rest on just like, we're just going to rake in the cash and the laughs now, because we're talking about gay marriage, we're guaranteed to get that watch. Whether the person's here to agree with us or hates us, they're going to pay the money to come and see us. And that sucks. Right.
I mean, it really, that's why I say the original DNA of this film is where I have a big problem with I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, because when the script was originally written, like, it was before Massachusetts, as an example, had legalized gay marriage. Because mm-hmm. I remember I was a senior in high school. It was 2004. And I was going to go get married to a man just to show my support for the fact that it could get done, right? To show some solidarity.
And high school. I missed
yeah,
those
right?
days.
I was young. I didn't truly understand it. I was talked out of doing it because there could be issues later on in your life because you married a man, Devin. Which, like, that, like, in retrospect, in 2022, that's a weird thought to have. And that's, like, a weird, like, bit of, I guess, advice that I was given, like, just the way that it was worded, right? It's yeah, more, yeah. You shouldn't get married at 18. Not the fact that...
Period.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's just weird. It was just a weird sort of situation. And maybe it's one of the reasons why I don't really respect marriage as a thing now in 2022.
Man, I'm learning some life lessons tonight.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just one of those situations. But if you set this in Boston in 2007, the idea of them becoming domestic partners, that's what they should do. But you have them actually get, you know, married as two men and take part in the fact that gay marriage is legal in Boston, then everything that they're doing actually becomes fraud. Like, there were places in this country in 2007 where gay couples didn't have to hide under the title of domestic partners. They could actually get married. So it also feels like weirdly behind the times for where things were politically.
Yeah. So the movie, it's weird because the movie does the smart thing where they say, why aren't people going to ask questions? And you hear Larry say no, because privacy laws are, like, super strict nowadays. And, like, that idea being like, no, people literally aren't allowed to ask questions. And so, like, there's that element to it, like, where they acknowledge that. But then the movie ignores that. All anybody does is ask questions for the rest of the movie.
Okay, so there's this moment in this movie, and we don't really talk about them a lot on the ASCU, but it's one of those dangling threads for me, and it's the moment where Glenn, the initial interviewer, comes out, and he says, were you trying to keep your partnership a secret? And I wonder how things would have gone if he had just said yes in that moment. Mm-hmm. Because, like, at that point, would they peel so deeply into it? Would they continue investigating? Like, it's just the fact that, no, like, we need to be partners because of the fact that my wife is not here and he's living here and I need his help to take care of my house.
Yeah.
And we lived together at the firehouse. It wasn't a huge, strange transition for us.
Right.
Like, I don't know. The fact that they are domestic partners in this film and everybody just assumes that that means that they're gay married is so upsetting to me. And not just through the lens of 2022, but through the lens of 2007.
Yeah, no, man. Like I said, even at the time, it definitely it was preying on an ignorance in the public and in a fear in the public that it, I mean, it makes it gross. It makes it a gross endeavor for sure.
Okay, so I'm sorry. I needed to blow that off because it is. It's really the shadow that is cast upon this movie for me fact that I really don't know. And the fact that the lawyer, like, first of all, this movie just plays on ignorance because their lawyer, if they told their lawyer, we entered into this domestic partnership so that if I were to pass away, you know, he would get my pension benefits and could help and would raise my children. The lawyer, first of all, you have attorney-client privilege. So she's not going to call up City Hall and say, these guys are committing fraud, Your Honor. She's going to say, oh, then you guys are in the clear. Because you're legally doing the correct thing.
Yeah, this movie presupposes the idea that love is a legal requirement for marriage.
I hate that part too. Like, every marriage is unique. To people could be married and sleep in different beds. For Christ's sake, the Ricardos did it for so many years.
Yeah.
Like, why do they need to sleep in the same bed? Why can't they have their own rooms, right? They could still love each other. I mean, let me tell you, here's just a true statement from Devin Decker, because I guess I'm getting real tonight in this episode of the ASCU. A perfect marriage situation for me was that we would have a room with the big bed so that we could sleep together or maybe engage in, you know, passionate times together. But then I'd also really like us to both have our own rooms. If, like, man, I'm going to be up late tonight and I don't want to disturb you.
They should have sent a poet, man. That was beautiful.
like my idea, like just because I want to marry somebody or spend the rest of my life with somebody does not mean I want to sleep in the same bed with them every night. Does that mean that my presupposed fictitious marriage in this situation means less than those marriages where people do? Like,
yeah. Well, and what's really weird is that it does all of this. And then it goes out of its way to show glimpses into the outside world where they think like us, right? So, like, there's, like, I think of the moment where they're having the conversation with Alex in the coffee shop about how Chuck sleeps around and Larry knows it. And, like, and that's just – and it's because that's just something that Larry needs to do, but he comes home every night and that's good enough for Larry, right? It's something that Chuck needs to do and that's good enough for Larry. Like, and that is, like, a weird, like, kind of progressive thinking in terms of some relationships like you're talking about. But the big thing for me is at the end where when they reveal everything and talk about why they did what they did and the fact that they still believe that they did the right thing and would continue to be together for the kids and all that stuff, that they're not rejected by the gay community that had fought for this domestic partnership stuff. They're embraced by them for displaying this idea that love is not a monolith, right? And so we get the sense that everybody else in the world kind of knows that. It's just this one group of people in New York City that all seem to be a bunch of ignorant idiots.
It's really just Steve Buscemi. And how did they get Steve Buscemi in this movie? He's an Oscar winner, for Christ's sake.
Well, you see his brother's in it.
Oh, so right. His brother's there. That makes perfect sense. I have no more questions about why Steve Buscemi would be in an Adam Sandler movie. Sorry, I is my favorite part of doing one of these movies that Steve Buscemi is in. I thrill whenever I start one knowing that Steve Buscemi's in it. It really seems like Clint Fitzer is the only person who has a problem with this type of coupling, right?
And he is the villain of this movie. Like, let's not act like they don't make it a point to show you that, yes, he is the only person that really has a problem with this. And yes, he's a bit of a prick.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, he has that one line that, like, would be immortalized if I were going to make a poster to sell at Hot Topic to go in every dorm room in America of, like, top villain quotes. This isn't very homosexual garbage.
This is very homosexual garbage.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, yes, they threw away a copy of Madden 06, but you throw away Madden when the new one comes out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I just want to make it clear in this moment when we talk about Buscemi and how horrible this character is and stuff like that, that, like, I acknowledge that he is supposed to be horrible. The movie wants me to think he's horrible. So I don't hold him and his characteristics in any way against this film, because I think they do a great job in introducing this government narc that has very conservative traditional views about what a marriage should be, and he is just ripping this couple to shreds with the most inappropriate kind of questioning. I mean, like it's just he is the perfect villain for this type of story, and Buscemi, of course, plays it perfectly.
Yeah,
like,
he plays
the line I always think of for him is, remind me not to go swimming with a dolphin. Like,
remind me not to go skinny dipping with any bottlenose dolphins, huh?
And the
bailiff is just like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want people to think we're friends.
Yeah.
I don't what has happened here?
Yeah.
It is. I don't know. It's just very the movie upsets me, but like, And we're not even talking about some of the upsetting things that actually happen in this movie. Like, yeah, in terms of what was funny in 2007 and what wasn't funny in 1960, but for some reason we're still visiting in 2007, which seems like a pretty solid transition point into something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. That Adam Sandler cinematic universe gem, where we focus on things that are new to what would be the Adam Sandler cinematic universe we're creating, something old from that universe, something borrowed, and something blue. And definition of blue to be determined. So, Siege, I'd really like to go first on old, so I will let you take new.
Yeah, so new, this is the first time, and perhaps not the last, maybe even in this own season, where we meet creepy Sandler, like the lecherous Sandler, right? Like he is, we have never seen him like he is in this movie, be so outwardly in acting, right? There's this idea that there's a type of acting where you can lead with physical parts of your body, and the three most often led parts are: you lead with your head, you lead with your chest, or you lead with your dick, right? And very, very often he plays characters that lead with their chest. It means that like they burst into a room and like Superman, like hands on the hip, and they like make silly statements and stuff like that. And you can literally see shots of him like that in like Billy Madison and in Happy Gilmore, blah blah blah, right? Very rarely does he do lead with his head characters. It happens in goofier, simpler projects.
Pixels is probably one where he leads with his head, because he doesn't have the confidence because it was broken in the 80s.
So he
leads with his knowledge. That's what actually allows him to feel big in these rooms with important people.
Well, and I think Little Nicky, for instance, is another one I would point to. I think Nicky leads with his head for sure.
Yeah.
But this idea that this is the first time we've seen a character of Sandler's that leads with his dick. Like, everywhere he goes, he is going because his cock is dragging him there. And, like, that's the character. But as I said, this isn't the last time that we see this. And it becomes something that is even kind of like a subplot to the Sandler universe, because this is also that point in his career where you start to see, like, kind of the next hot big thing get a small role in the movie, just so that Sandler gets to have a scene with her in a bikini. So like in this movie it's Tila Tequila, right? And then like in future movies we see things like is it Anger Management where Heather Graham shows up in the Boston Red Sox bikini?
That's 2003. So that's the start of that, and this is just a continuation.
Right, and you get these moments in these movies going forward where he as a film creator, not even just as a character, although I do mean as a character, but as a film creator, we also see a couple of kind of iffy moments in which like much younger women are brought in to play love interests, or at least what's the word I'm looking for? Like centerfold style, like just put on display for 5 minutes in the movie as a character. And then they disappear. They don't mean anything. They never show up again. You know, this is outside of the Sandler verse. This is very famous in things like the old Vacation movies, the woman that shows up in the car, right?
Christie Brinkley?
Right, yeah. But that bit, right?
Of yeah.
Like where for 5 minutes, no lines on screen, we're going to get the latest swimsuit model to come on screen, and she's going to be wearing the skimpiest outfit we're allowed to put in a PG-13 movie. Like, and that is something that gets added to the pot here that I don't think we've ever really seen before.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're going to talk about creepy, lecherous Adam Sandler, now seems to be a pretty good time to talk about the part where Chuck, under false pretenses of being a homosexual man, kind of just has his hands on Jennifer Beals' breasts for 5 straight minutes. He even plays the bongos.
Yeah, just like full on takes advantage of her in a situation in which he's lying to her. Like it is disgusting.
And that is also another moment that just feels like a relic of the past that this film was written in. Because if I learned one thing from college, one thing from the University of Rhode Island, it is that everybody loves breasts. Perhaps the gayest professor that I had at the University of Rhode Island, he told me, he's like, let me tell you a secret, Devin. Everybody loves breasts. I will not divulge his name, but if you know me and you were there, you know who I'm talking about. And maybe there's a reason he said, we can no longer be Facebook friends, Devin. And maybe I solved the mystery of my own life looking at the more villainous portrayals of Adam Sandler. But it's just one of those things that just, in 2007, like, a woman would still be like, well, feel this because there's not going to be any sexual, like, meaning behind it if you're a gay man. But on some level, she has to know you still love breasts, right? Because you're a human being.
Well, and even outside of that, everybody has their own idea of privacy. Even
right.
I, who have been in a relationship with a woman for 6 years, still have that moment of the day where I need to get ready to like get in the shower and stuff, and I'd rather she not be in the room, right? Like everybody has that line. Again,
Seinfeld, good naked, bad naked.
Everybody has a line in which they're willing to allow a partner to be near them in personal intimate times, right? And I mean, like this even goes beyond things like sexuality. Like, let's say just going to the bathroom. There are couples out there where they don't mind going to the bathroom with the door open and people walking in and out of the bathroom. Like, I'm never going to understand that. But, like, more power to those couples. They've got a couple more minutes in their day where they can talk to each other, I guess. But, like
their bathrooms must have better acoustics than my bathroom, then. That's all I'm going to say. I don't know if you remember the downstairs bathroom, but if you use that restroom, everybody in the living room knows what you're doing. Door open, closed, or radio on.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But the so that idea that like that despite whatever their relationship is, no matter what she understands him to be in terms of sexuality, she would still have a sense of privacy about her that she is just willingly opening. And that's, you know, that is also something that people can and do. So like, that's fine. But as you pointed out, it's all under this pretense of she has one understanding of the context of the situation, and it is not correct.
I mean, even with that understanding of the context, I mean, I already said I think Alex McDonough may be a secret villain in this film. She is attracted to Chuck. It's undeniable that on some level, she is attracted to Chuck Levine. Mm-hmm. So, like, it's almost, I struggle to
do
it.
That doesn't make her villainous. What
no,
you say?
That's not the thing. But I mean, but then there's the moment where they eventually do kiss and she's like, oh my God, I've betrayed Larry. I believe in marriage. Like, yeah, you do that stuff, but that doesn't mean that you haven't been, like, kind of putting out the vibe every time you and Chuck are alone. Like,
yeah,
you have to own a little
put a vibe out.
Right, exactly. I know. No, and again, that's not what Sandler's villainous, but it's just one of those things where, like, I'm okay saying that she's not this perfect angelic character in the film. She has flaws as well.
You're right. She is a complicated character. Like, honestly, for what we have seen for female characters in these particular Sandler films, very often just relegated to just being kind of one note and like there for the story, if not the joke. Like, she actually brings a lot to this movie in terms of complication. So, like, lover or hater, I do think she's a great character.
Yeah, I just think that your lawyer should probably not advise you to take a domestic partnership and legitimize it by getting married in another country. That seems like poor lawyerly advice.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're not wrong. I mean, again, that comes from this movie, the world in which this movie wants you to believe exists, but it doesn't. Right. So, like, you're right in our world, but unfortunately.
But in perhaps the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, as we're here to determine, maybe not.
So what's your new, by the way, Dev?
This is the first time Adam Sandler plays Dracula!
Yeah! Excellent.
I mean, Dracula Adams gonna be a big deal whenever we decide we're doing the Hotel Transylvania 1, 2, 3, not 4, but we'll talk about that eventually, I'm sure. And
I mean, why would we not do 4? Hell, we could basically do a whole season of Daddy Adam.
You know that Adam Sandler's not in Hotel Transylvania Transformania, right?
No, I did not know
no,
that.
No, he's been replaced by a sound-alike.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's gonna be something that we'll definitely talk about on this show once we get to Hotel Transylvania. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's something we discuss on the Say Report, if you're interested in cross pollinating, listener. But yeah, seeing him dressed as Dracula, I kind of like gleed. I was like kind of excited that like Adam Sandler, he's always kind of had a thing for Dracula, hasn't he? And going one step beyond, I think the reason why Kevin James ultimately goes on to play Frankenstein in the Hotel Transylvania movies is the joke of, I got some bad news for you, buddy. They had to remove your entire body. You're just the head. But they're building you a new one.
Yeah, man. Just because you've mentioned that moment, like that is one of those moments for me that I think is a great working bit of this film. And that includes everything leading up to them being in the hospital, too. So that whole moment when they first get to that burned out station, they have to go in. And like, yeah, the conversation they have is gross. And yes, there's definitely bits that we learn about them as characters that are not great. But all of it is really good character development for learning where they currently are versus where we know eventually this movie is going to go. And then you take all of that and then you throw in that harrowing save the cat moment where they're goofing around with the rat moment, right?
Yeah, I mean,
they're goofing around with each other. My favorite line in this movie is in that scene. Oh, I dropped a rat. We'll have to try this later. I laugh at that bit every fucking time.
It's good every time. The delivery, it's this perfect moment of just like, it's that Spider-Man trying to diffuse the seriousness of this situation with a joke. It's very good. Yeah. But Dracula Adam, I was so I forgot that he dresses as a vampire in this. And then what, 2 years later, he's playing him in animated form? It's fantastic. It's wonderful. Yeah. Good for you. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry.
Yeah, no, Drax Sandler is a great pull, man.
Yeah.
So you wanted to go first on old, right?
Yeah, because I want to be the one who gets to say, the puppy that lost its way.
Nice. Very nice. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's not much to do from that, but it's kind of a big focal point of what would easily be considered the first film in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, Billy Madison, coming forward into this film 12 years later, right? Mathematically? Yeah. 12 years later. Yeah.
Yeah, so but yeah, I mean, also one of our first kind of big hints that we may be looking at a movie that is within the universe. Like the idea that this book is there is our first kind of like eyebrow raise, like, oh, maybe, right? The old for me, and this is only because we often talk about the covert Covert, but it was nice to get back to Alan Covert having like a character for a moment. Oh.
It is almost the perfect covert Covert.
Yeah,
this was like my I wrote in my notes, it says nominee for perfect covert Covert, because I thought, oh, he's just gonna be one of the parents at a career day, and that's enough for me. Like, that's enough to be like, oh, look, there's Alan Covert. Ha ha. And then he's a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
It, like, you want to talk about villain films, we're going to talk about the ones where Alan Covert is definitely one of the worst people who lives in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, and like, he so earnestly and without any malice delivers the most horrendous fucking lines to Kevin James in that moment. Like, and I wanted Kevin James to like to take him, and then he does. It's a beautifully cathartic moment when he fucking tackles him, and then they just show him just fucking like elbowing him in the ass. There's a lot of that kind of stuff that goes on in this movie, right? Like, and this may be hint number two, but the idea being that, like, you get a lot of these moments where you're like, oh, yeah, that guy, like, I love, yeah. And this is not necessarily a great thing, because I do think this is just more of kind of, I'm going to label it now, because this is what it is, the Sandler lazy effect. Like it's starting to become easy for him to get a laugh out of the audience by making sure that this guy slips into the movie at this part, that this bit shows up, that this physical shtick happens, and then boom, you got yourself $100 million, baby. And that becomes the Sandler formula, and it is part of what feeds into the idea that people get really kind of shitty about the idea that a guy can be handed $85 million to do this kind of shit that nobody seems to like, but then still makes $185 million in the end. And like, and this goes on even to this day, this attitude, because like just this past week, were you the one that shared with me the story about The Longest Yard on Netflix?
No.
They just posted The Longest Yard on Netflix, and it's been sitting in the number 10, the top 10 slots for Netflix since it got onto the site. Like, what the fuck? It's The Longest Yard. It's an Adam Sandler remake that wasn't even that well received when it came out. But ever since it's been added to Netflix, it's been up in that top 10. And somebody did a whole write-up on, like, the idea being that this is actually not the first time this has happened. It's a pretty tried-and-true formula for Netflix, that anytime they want to kind of bump up some Sandler-ness into the world because they've got the rights to his life at this point, they hit him up for one of his old movies, throw it on the site for a couple of months, and it stays in the top 10 almost, like, for like 3 or 4 weeks at a time, and then it sits around, gets watched a little bit more, and then they release it. It's like, it's one of the easiest ways for them to guarantee viewership is an Adam Sandler movie just picked at random. And like,
and can I just say hooray for Netflix, because the reason it's The Longest Yard is to drum up interest in Home Team, the Kevin James Sean Payton sort of biopic that is dropping on January 28th.
Produced by Happy Madison.
That is definitely
right?
A Happy Madison picture. And let me tell you, there are people who are interested in that film who are going to go and search for it, see that it's not available till the 28th, but here's some other films that might interest you. And in that number one spot, and I know this for a fact because that's what my father did when we were looking for something to watch over the weekend, is The Longest Yard.
Yeah.
So people who want to see this new movie are getting filtered right into it. So like, as much as like Netflix can be the hero or the villain depending on the day, they definitely have a lock on how to retain viewers and membership.
And so does, and to that same point, so does somebody like Sandler. And that's the thing that makes him kind of villainous in this movie for me, because once again, it is the Sandler lazy effect. He's just able to just kind of roll onto a set, do what he wants for a few weeks, and then roll off, and then he's good. Like, him and his friends walk away making bank. And that is not something that anybody can do. And so you make a lot of enemies, like, being able to do that kind of stuff. And I mean that not in like people in Hollywood hate him, but like people around here that like see that working for him do nothing but talk shit while also spending money on the ticket to go see the movie.
Right. Exactly. Well, because I don't feel as guilty if I talk shit about it. Right.
Yeah,
I'm in the know, and I understand that Adam Sandler's just making movies to take a vacation or to hang out with his friends. So because I can identify that, I'm almost doing it as a goof going to see this movie because I'm in on the bit. It's marketing from everything. So not just hooray for Netflix, hooray for Adam Sandler. Also,
it's a sad Alan Covert, like appearance because it does all reek of that. Because like, it's a phenomenal moment in the movie when it happens, but you cannot help but think like, well, they plan, like that was in the book. Like, that was literally the playbook. Like, that had to happen at some point, right?
Yes, sir. While we're still under the old title. Really, like this, like we talked about Michael Buscemi being in Blended, but this is one of those other times that Michael Buscemi shows up in the film. Ditto other brothers of famous people that Adam Sandler has worked with the fact that John Turturro's brother shows up in this one. I can't think of his name right now.
Yeah, it's like Charlie or something like that.
Yeah, it's another Turturro, Nicholas Turturro, who's the 5-year younger brother of John Turturro, who's in Mr. Deeds. You also have Gary Valentine showing up, who is Kevin James's real brother.
Yeah, and then lends his name to the movie.
Definitely lends his name to his brother's character. You have all those old ones, like that old thing is coming in again. But also, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and we'll see if I am, I think this is the first time that Dennis is his character, and Just Shoot Me, I do it every time, that David Spade actually factually shows up in one of the films with Adam Sandler. I know he's been in Happy Madison Productions before, but I think this is the first time that they interact in an Adam Sandler film.
I mean, I can definitely get behind that until I do a little bit more research here.
Right, but that's what the show's about.
Also to that effect, like, I mean, you have Farley brothers that show up in this one. Like, I mean, there's a whole bunch of the ones that they fall back on.
Yeah. Peter Dante, John Loughran actually having definitive characters again and not just being like a one scene cameo for the laugh and the, oh, I know that guy. This is another one that almost invites everybody back to show up for one scene or another. And especially after something like 8 Crazy Nights, where they got absolutely everybody possible, I feel like it's worth mentioning. Also, like, Nick Swardson, we know he's been doing stuff, and we've talked about it on the show. I think this is the first one that he's properly in an Adam Sandler film.
Yeah. They're both, Grandma's Boy,
Grandma's
Sandler's
Boy, Adam Sandler's not in it.
Transformers, yeah. Dickie Roberts, yeah, man, this, like, might be kind of the first time that he definitely shows up, for sure.
So they're old to us, but new to appearing with Adam in this one, so they exist in that sort of weird double space.
Mm-hmm.
All right, which brings us to Borrowed, and Seijin, what's your Borrowed for this film?
So this is actually something that was really interesting, because it didn't really occur to me until as I was watching it this time, but this idea of the gender comedy, but mixed with like the buddy comedy. And that is actually a formula that we've seen a few times before, not too often, but like we see it in, like, for instance, famously on television, you have Bosom Buddies, right? That was like the big one that I was thinking of a lot of the time with this, the idea that it's a show that forces two men into uncomfortable gender positions, quote unquote. And please, I'm putting quotes around that, in order to make political statements, bring comedy, bring levity to serious like situations. Right. But there's other versions of this, too. The other movie I think of when I say this is like Tu Wong Fu, which is Wesley Snipes. Is it John Leguizamo and Kurt Russell? Or,
oh, like, my God, it's Patrick Swayze. Crazy for Swayze.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that is one that deals in a lot of this too. Is like a lot of the comedy comes from seeing masculine men in effeminate like situations and things like that. The other one that I think of, and this is a little bit more of an indie pull, but one of Mark Duplass's earliest films is Hump Day. Do you remember this film at all? It's filmed like all on like home video.
Yeah,
film. Like,
I know it. I've never seen it.
So it's one of his earliest films, and it really kind of launches him and his brother's career into making more in movies. But it's all about two guys that realize that there's some money to be made, and for various situations they need it desperately. If they film a gay porn together, and they're two best friends, and it's all about leading up to the day that they film it, and them going through their feelings, dealing with partners and family when they've made this decision, and blah blah blah. And there's comedy to be had, but there's the serious discussion also going on about identity. Identity and gender and sexuality, all leading up to these two presumably straight men who are about to film a gay scene together, right? And so there was also kind of that ghosting into this for me, because like it is something that we have seen handled before. We have seen other people, other actors and artists, writers, directors who have tackled the idea of like gender comedy, gender. What's the best way to, like, there's not even like a real word for it, but this idea that it presents queer gender comedy. I think that's probably the best way to talk about it, but also mixed with that buddy aspect, because a lot of the other comedy that is in this movie and a lot of where it comes from is the fact that they are friends and there is this friendly like relationship that's going on between them.
Would it be the bromance comedy then? Like, I think that's...
So bromance is definitely here, but not the same thing. Gotcha. Because when I think about a bromance comedy, the joke with the bromance comedy is how masculine everybody's behaving. It just is pointing out how there are masculine behaviors that are identifiable as actually romantic. And you see some of that on display here for sure. One of the biggest bits of that is the basketball game in the first moments. Like, there is... No, like, it is on purpose the amount of ass slapping you see in that scene, right? Like there's like moments like that, right? And that is definitely bromantic. But the more like gender queering nature of the whole thing is like when they have to act like a couple and hold hands, and like those moments when we laugh because they're acting like they love one another, and we know that that's not how they love one another. And like, I'm not saying I that that's good comedy. That is the comedy.
It's just the comedy there. That happens to
right,
exist.
Right,
I get that. I'm so glad you gave several examples, because I too have several examples, and I think I'm going to go from easiest to the one that's a bit of a stretch, but I'm kind of proud of. In the third act, this film turns into Green Card. It's kind of undeniable that this film turns into Green Card with the, they're going to quiz you about everything about one another. And luckily, because Chuck and Larry have known each other since 1987, so for 20 years, they have that on lock. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not like, it's not like in Green Card where Gerard Depardieu needs to learn the type of shampoo that Andy McDowell uses, but it's very like, it's gonna be Green Card. You're gonna be tested.
Now that you said Gerard Depardieu and Andy McDowell, I'm now thinking of Green Card. I gotta be honest, I thought you were talking about Green Book for a while, and I was like, this will be an interesting one. Okay.
That would be hurt. No, I'm talking about Green Card from the late 80s, maybe early 90s.
A man and a woman who get married so that he can stay in the country, right? And then they get quizzed on whether, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they think it's not going to be a problem. You're just going to have your mail sent to my house. But again, some bureaucrat has a hair up his ass and decides, I'm going to focus on ruining these two people's day. So actually, it's a lot more Green Card than I gave it credit for, which is probably why I'm going to lead with Green Card. And then I'm going to transition into Spartacus, because there's this moment where it turns into Spartacus.
That's true, in the courtroom in the end there.
And I'm a big fan of the whole, I picked out his dress.
I picked out his dress. Oh, man.
And I caught the bouquet in my teeth. I liked it. So Spartacus, that's it. And now I'm going to go to the one that's a stretch, but I'm really kind of proud of it, because it allows me to flex my movie muscle. Love my movie muscle. And that is Single White Female.
Oh, man. Okay, yeah.
And the reason why I feel it borrows from Single White Female is in Single White Female, big spoilers for Single White Female. If you've not seen Single White Female and you thought that wasn't going to be a problem listening to this Adam Sandler podcast, pause it now. Go watch Single White Female and then come back, because I'm going to spoil the big moment in Single White Female right now.
Watch that movie, then nod when you say, oh, that's where this trope comes from, and then come back to us.
Yeah. So in that film, Jennifer Jason Leigh moves in. Is that her name? Jennifer Lee Cook? Is that?
Yeah, I think it's Jennifer Lee. Oh, man. Why are you doing this?
Can you look up her name for me? Yes. So Cesar will have her name for us. Moves in with Bridget Fonda and then decides to basically emulate and try to become Bridget Fonda's character. And
Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Okay, so good. So Jennifer Jason Leigh is the other one. So the whole thing is that she basically wants to steal and assume Bridget Fonda's life. And the final domino that has to topple for her to feel like she's won is to bed her boyfriend, who's portrayed by Steven Weber in the film. So there's this whole sequence where she arranges it so that Steven Weber thinks that he's going to go sleep with Bridget Fonda. And then after the sex happens, it's revealed to be Jennifer Jason Leigh. And I know it's going to be a stretch, but because Jennifer Jason Leigh was unavailable for the sex scene, like she was like on another set or she was just late to set that day, the whole sex scene in this fake out moment is shot with Bridget Fonda. So that, like, the movie is outright fucking lying to you. And yeah, making you think that Steven Weber is actually just sleeping with his girlfriend, and then the lights come up and, oh, gotcha, it was Jennifer Jason Leigh the whole time.
Right.
And the reason that relates to I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry is at that costume party to raise funds for AIDS research, which, I mean, like, that whole costume party, I just want to, like, take a moment and give a round of applause for, because they threw a fucking believable party in that moment, right down to the big bowl of condoms. Like, if you're throwing an AIDS refund research fundraiser, you should have condoms in the bathroom. It's just one of those things, man. And it's just really good party planning. Sorry, but back to it. At that costume party, there is a moment where Dracula Adam gazes out across the room and sees a Playboy bunny and thinks, oh, that's Alex. That's Jessica Biel. And he goes over and then he makes like kind of a Letras comic where I want to suck your blood. And then turn around and it's David Spade. But it hasn't been David Spade the whole time. It is Jessica Biel up until the turn reveal. So they single white female you, man. And I felt just as betrayed.
I also applaud you for bringing single white female to the show today, because one of the top billed casts as the neighbor in that movie is Frances Bay, who famously played Happy's grandmother in Happy Gilmore.
So
I don't think it's the first time he's probably seen that movie.
I mean, it's just, it's like, everybody saw Green Card. Everybody has seen Green Card. I feel like it's one of those films you do. Ditto, like, if you haven't seen Spartacus, you know the, I am Spartacus. I am Spartacus. I'm Jerry. It's supposed to be saying with Spartacus, Jerry. I'm Spartacus. But single white female, it's kind of a deep pull. But like one of those moments where I'm like, oh yeah, that's definitely Jessica Biel. And then it's like, oh no, right. Because David Spade has that cameo as the cross dresser that like sort of feels like it's being referenced in Jack and Jill. And I had to go back and confirm that.
Yeah. Are they not the same character?
I don't think they're the same character. I'm fairly certain that in this film, it is supposed to be a man who is dressed as a woman, but in Jack and Jill is just supposed he's just playing a female role. Like I don't know. We'll have to determine that later on down the line. Like, I think it's almost legitimized the Jill character in the fact that there are mannish women in this world. We're not here to talk about Jack and Jill. We're here to talk about I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, even though twins also make an appearance in both. But it's single white female is all I could think of when I confirmed that it is Jessica Biel up until the reveal that it is David Spade.
Man. So do we want to do Blue?
Yeah, I think we have to do Blue. I think the blueness of this film is one of the big problems with it. And well, I'm going to start, and it's Chuck's robe during the little reading. It's the bluest blue I've ever seen, Seijin. It says, blue is the blue in my dreams.
I really like that scene, too. I think there's a lot of really good writing in that moment, and the two of them do really good. We haven't really talked enough about the relationship between him and Kevin James, and this is a good moment too, because like that moment, that is a perfect example of it. Like that there is so much going on there, and I love it. And yes, he is wearing the bluest of blue robes as he hobbles around his house in
Charlie Chaplin. Which could have also been borrowed. When he just picks up that alcohol, I don't know what type of alcohol that is. It looks like Cannonball Rum. And he just like takes it to the bean.
Yeah, it's tequila, I'm pretty sure. It's like a Don Juan. I can't think of the full brand name on it. But he just starts just chugging it. And then he puts it down and very politely goes, I'm going to have to pass.
I'm going to have to pass. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those moments, too, where that scene is sort of the perfect microcosm of what is going on in this film. Yeah. Because real emotion is being brought up in that moment with the whole, like, imagine my kids, right? Like, you get to go on living your life, but they're in Bangladesh. And there's the memory of my kids that you could have done something and you didn't. But then it's also all after, like, two pretty heavy usage of derogative terms for homosexual males. And then, like, the white knight savior moment of, well, actually, the preferred nomenclature is gay.
Okay.
Thanks, Kevin James, in this moment. Like, it is all of the tonal deafness of this film, like, right alongside all of the real, like, deep emotional shit that is actually going on in the lives of these two New York firefighters.
Yeah, it's just what it is for me is, again, it's one of those moments where for a second you have the conversation in your head, are they doing this to teach me a lesson or are they doing this because they're idiots? And you always come to the conclusion that it's because they're idiots. But there is that moment where you feel like there is a certain subsect of an Adam Sandler audience that will use that word freely still to this day, right? And the fact that it gets called out there, and at the end of this movie there is a moment in which it is openly referenced as maybe we shouldn't say this word anymore, right? Like, so it's
but I don't know if Fat Boy is on the same fucking level as the other two derogative terms.
I thought that was gonna be what he gets called out on, and then he doesn't, and I was a little pissed about that. But it's an ape with a cudgel when a surgeon with a scalpel is what you need, right? Like, that's what those moments are. And, like, you know, I at the same time, I it's nice to know that the ape is on our side.
Exactly. It's nice to know that the ape is, I mean, but at any time that ape could go crazy and start throwing its shit at us, each. And
that's true. And that was it. They do in Grandma's Boy.
But yeah, it really is one of those moments that just makes you go, ooh. That just is all over this film, unfortunately.
Yeah, which is why it was really hard for me to kind of narrow down a blue myself. But then I realized something, and I think that the movie probably wanted me to do this, but I don't care. I'm going to take the bait. Of all of the things in this movie that are super offensive, somehow, some way, Rob Schneider's portrayal of an Asian character somehow still manages to come out as the most offensive thing.
Oh, as Mickey Rooney from Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is another borrowed I could grab, but I threw it in the synopsis.
But it had to be that's what it is, right? Like, that's the only thing I could think of. And so with that in mind, is the point that, like, look, you want us to be offensive, we could be offensive, but I tricked you, we're going to be offensive about this other thing. Like, what is the weird, like magic trick they're trying to pull by putting him on screen in that getup with that voice in those moments? Like, what is the bit? I just don't get it. And
the
so that's
bit,
why
Sijin,
I think
is that it's a circle. It's not a triangle that's got points. It's not a rectangle that ends a bunch of places. It's a circle.
The lines work even without a stupid voice dump.
I know. That was the goal. Thanks. Yeah, the person I feel the worst for in that moment is the piano player at the Two Hearts Chapel, who is definitely an actor of Asian descent. And, like, she just has to sit there and suffer as they do that.
Yeah, well, you mean like they always seem to do with Rob Schneider is they have him behave like this in front of people of the actual like culture in which he is portraying? Yeah, I don't get it. I don't understand why Schneider like thinks this is a good bit. I don't know why they let him continue to do this. And I don't mean to like act like he somehow walks on set and just has the run of the fucking show. But they clearly are like, yeah, I don't know. He worked on SNL for a while. Like he knows what he's doing. He's definitely bringing a lot to these characters, and it ain't great.
Yeah. And the really weird thing is you have Blake Clark in the scene as well as the crazy homeless guy who acts as their witness. Because let's be honest, I'm not paying $100 for a witness. That's the weirdest thing in that whole Two Hearts thing. And there's a lot of weird things in it that like, oh, we are definitely in the business of fake marriage, of fake homosexual marriages. Just like for the record. Tell your friends who are trying to defraud the government to come to Two Hearts.
I got more the impression that we are willing to do this when other chapels are not, and I know it's not always easy for gay couples in this time to bring a third that agrees with what's going on. Like, I thought that's where they were going with it. I do also believe that they are in the business of shady shit, don't get me wrong, but I think the idea that they are one of the few chapels in the area that does gay marriages, and on top of that they will provide a witness, is more about a statement of, we know that this is sometimes the only option for people in this position. And like, and so it's another one of those moments of like, oh yeah, like conceptually, like this could have been a really important conversation to have, but they never address it enough for that to become the conversation though.
Yeah, it's the microtransaction add-on feeling of the witness. It would be one thing if they just had a witness on staff and that $89 that they so prominently display on their marquee was like, that was included in it. The fact that it is an additional $100 for that witness really feels like, I mean, if it's not the fact that it's like something scummy is going on, they're taking advantage of the situation. It's also the fact that, like, we know you can't go anywhere else, and we're going to grease our palms that much more so that you can get married.
Yeah.
Like, it's not good no matter what.
He's a real Thénardier, I gotta tell you. Yeah, no, I don't understand. So in a movie that, as you rightly pointed out, is full of blue moments and shades of blue and the ways in which it handles its core material alone, to then on top of that bring in this completely unnecessary caricature, and I can only imagine that the thinking was like this is going to be so far left field from what people are expecting compared to the rest of this movie that's the bit, but it doesn't work. It doesn't land.
I mean, that shade of blue that Chuck's robe is actually called Rob Schneider, and I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry Blue. sorry, I just had to. Oh, no, but then it's also Blake Clark at the wedding. I completely lost that thread. He does the dance that is done in Eight Crazy Nights when Schneider is also playing a horrific Asian stereotype.
Well, he's doing a traditional Jewish dance is what he's doing.
but I understand that. But it's that fact that, like, it weirdly juxtaposes that to, like, remind you. And, like, we've had Schneider do this before. Mm-hmm. And like, but now we got him in the glasses. Now we got him in the buck teeth. Now we got him with the big fake nose. Now we got him with the haircut. Like, we're capable of being offensive. Like, it almost feels like a call out, an answer to any of the criticism and critique they got about Rob Schneider playing that character in Eight Crazy Nights.
Yeah, man.
Like, it almost feels like statement.
Yeah, it's weird. It's fucking weird. In this movie that is already trying to make a certain political statement to muddy the waters with this character is completely unnecessary and harms the film.
Yeah, no, harms the film. That's the perfect way to put it.
You know, a couple of other things that I've got written here. We have not really mentioned the fact that Ving Rhames is in this movie. I like Ving Rhames in this movie.
Yeah, no, I love Ving Rhames in this movie. I like that Ving Rhames takes part in the homosexual kiss with Nick Swartzen. Mm-hmm. Because I do recall when we went to go see Hairspray, and I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry, a little side bet going on which of the two would have a homosexual kiss between two men on screen. Uh-huh. And I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry is the team that won that bet. So... because of that moment. And then also come to find out that internationally, Chuck and Larry kiss.
Yeah.
It is only in America where they do not end up kissing so that the film could get a PG-13 rating.
Fucking dumb.
Which is that really is, just fucked up, right?
That's just fucked up. I mean, the whole oeuvre around this film is really weird. The marketing is really weird. Why is the poster Larry holding up Chuck and Larry looking like he's the crazy bro, and Chuck looking like he's like the sane one that's just along for the ride? Like, that's not their character types at all in this movie. And then there's the weird poster where it's the two of them with Jessica Biel, and she's not in on the bit, so like it doesn't make sense for her to be there. I just think that there was a lot of issues with this movie in terms of like they did not know how to sell it to an audience after it was made, and like, and I don't envy them having to try and figure out how to sell this movie, because like you have to imagine that just on paper alone, somebody goes, there's going to be a group of people offended by this. Great. And like, this was at a time where we didn't have social media, and you didn't have like the idea that at any moment one person could pull the trigger and the entirety of like the internet could just decide that you're the bad guy. Like, and you know, for good or for ill, like that is a power that does exist nowadays. We can't ignore it, right? And like this movie, even without any of that, you have to imagine that they were not happy that this was the movie they got saddled with trying to sell, right?
I think the one of the other things that is unfortunately going to become part of the discussion in this whole the villainous films of Adam Sandler, for better or for ill, is how the marketing portrayed these particular films. And yeah. I think that's going to be a bigger deal with the next film that we're looking into, which I'll announce it right now. We're deep into the episode and we'll remind you at the end. But the next film we're going to be looking at is Spanglish. And that is a film that 100% I submitted for consideration as an Adam Sandler villain, because everybody I talk to says I was so excited for that movie because of the advertising, and then I got Spanglish. So then you bringing up, I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry, and how the marketing for this movie seems to have no idea what film it is selling. Like, I think that that also feeds into why these films are remembered less than favorably by, like, the populace at large.
I mean, it left a bad taste in your mouth before you even saw it, and the movie doesn't ever do anything to help wash it out, like, plain and simple. So, like, it's one of those things where people... You know, marketing is part of the film. It is. Yeah. Like the ways in which that it contextualizes and sets up a movie before you go to see it is important. And the ways in which you interact with it going forward afterwards. Right. There are a lot of movies that I really liked as a kid that in later years, the ways in which they've been shoved down my throat, I don't necessarily ever want to go back to them again, you know, and that is because they've had large marketing teams get a hold of them and realize there's buck to be made and blah blah blah. But like this movie is a prime example of just like they had no idea what to do with it. They put out a couple of trailers that had some problematic stuff to begin with. You have Adam Sandler going out and talking about how he's making a movie that's going to save the gays, and then like this is the movie they get, and it's just like it tastes like crap, and it smelled like crap to begin with, and guess what, it tasted like it too.
Yeah, it's a weird one. It's a weird one from almost any way that you approach it. It's a weird one because it has scenes like when Ving Rhames' Frederick Duncan character approaches Chuck and thanks him for his strength so that he could finally come to terms with his sexuality and tell the world that he is gay. And like, that's a powerful moment. That is a moment that, in spite of myself, brought a tear to my eye. Because, like, so often, especially at this time in the world, and that is part of this film that feels sort of influenced by what was going on in culture at the time, was the fact that these people, like, Hollywood for a long time was very closeted. And this was one of those times where people were starting to come out and admit that I am a homosexual and that's the lifestyle that I choose. The big one that I think of is Barry from How I Met Your Mother. When Neil Patrick Harris came out and like
Barry,
that, I'm sorry, I'm an asshole. It was the perfect callback, Sejan. When he did come out as gay, and it was this big moment because like he made it okay, because we weren't gonna stop loving Neil Patrick Harris for everything else that he was doing at the time.
No, I mean, it's that famously problematic scenario where, like, where it's not real until it's happening to somebody close to you, and then that's when you learn your true feelings on it. And so, like, a lot of people really loved Neil Patrick Harris. It took him coming out for a lot of people to then be okay with homosexuality because they were okay with Neil Patrick Harris. So good for real. That's not really the way it should work. You should just love human beings for being human beings. But if it means that I don't have to have that political argument at Thanksgiving every year, then hey, I'll take it, right? Yeah.
I mean, it's insane to think that 15 years ago, just how different the world actually was.
Yes.
Like that's the thing. It's because also watching it, it's like, yeah, no, like that. This is the stuff that was going on in the world.
Well, and that's why I say the conversations that you hear between Larry and Chuck are also really, actually really well done and really important, is because as upsetting as some of their language can be, and as problematic as it can be, for me, it's no different than going back and watching old Kevin Smith stuff. Is like, I know people that talk like that. And, you know, obviously they're over the top characters, and like, not everybody talked like that. And maybe nobody, you know, talked just like that brash. But at the end of the day, someone, you know, did, right? And like, so there's conversations that they're having a bit with one another and about one another and you know, with each other and about their families and about their partners and all of this stuff that is, in a weird way, like it's endearing and nostalgic to me, because I do remember the way that people talk like that. Do I think that people should still talk? No, of course not. And like, do I think that if somebody does not want to be talked to that way, and they should have the right to say, hey, like, no, that's too far, like, let's not do that? Of course. But the relationship that they have, clearly they understand one another well enough to talk to each other in a certain way. Although that gets called into question later with the fat boy comment, as much as I hate that that is what is put up as the equivalent to other words in that moment. There is that acknowledgement that, like, I don't really love it when you do this thing. And it's okay for them to have that conversation. And like, the reaction between the two of them is really cute and endearing, right? Like, and it's just those moments, they make the rest of the film work for me. Not completely. The movie doesn't work for me, like, in its entirety, but I believe, like, certain stuff that happens in this film for sure. It's what makes moments like when the kids run in when they're in the hospital and they're like scared about the two of them, like, makes that work. Or the rehearsal moment in the kitchen later when they're sitting around and doing Annie Get Your Gun and Chuck is showing off the dance moves that he's been teaching Larry's kid, right? Like that, like, those moments do feel genuine and real and do work for me. And that is only because of the ways in which that they speak with one another, they interact with one another and all that.
I mean, do those moments work? Do those moments that are heavy hitting work because of how grounded in reality they are compared against all of the absurdity that is happening elsewhere in this film?
Oh no, it's jarring. It is super jarring. And that is why the larger film doesn't work. Is exactly that. Is because those moments, and you know, so you think about those moments in terms of like a Sideways or what's one of the other ones that Alexander Payne did? Like,
all I could think of is Sideways, Descendants,
Election, Nebraska, Descendants. Like there are these moments of real humans behaving like humans, and it's still being funny, and it's still being sad, because humans are actually in their everyday life kind of funny and kind of sad. And that's where like you could definitely see a lot of that stuff going on, the Alexander Payne stuff. It's when it gets absurd that it's so offensively absurd that it just wrecks the rest of the film.
Yeah. It's because it lives so much in the absurd that any sort of messaging that they have in this particular film is lost to it. Yeah. You get those moments, but those are not the moments that stick with you. The moments that stick with you are Dan Aykroyd just being kind of the worst character, like one of the worst Dan Aykroyd characters, with the way that he talks to them and the way, like, when Nick Turturro calls him a porcupine head, like, you're like, yeah, get him, like, fuck him.
Right. And it's this idea that he's playing this character that. It is hollow support.
Yeah.
And we see that a lot. Like, you see people that will tolerate homosexuality in this movie. That's the example, but it's true of all isms, right? They'll tolerate a certain type of person because they're that good of a guy. No, fuck you. Like, that's not how it works. That doesn't make you a good person just because you quote unquote tolerate me. Like, fuck you.
I mean, his tolerance is more to the fact that I know that something shady is going on. I'm not going to call you out on it.
Right.
Don't talk to it. Don't talk about about it in front of me. I know exactly. You two are not gay, because if my pencil sharpener had a skirt, you'd stick your dick in it, Chuck. Because I saw you do it once.
Because I saw you try it once. I know.
Like, I don't. It's he. And then his whole speech, like, about, like, I don't, like, so much of this movie just makes no sense. And yeah. It's funny because it's Dan Aykroyd using a lot of big words, and that's Dan Aykroyd's shtick, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's like, that helped nobody, what yeah. you just did. Like, all you did was
we're
come
all
in
having
here.
For having
like,
listened to it. Like,
we were, which can we talk about? I did not realize how big a part of the Adam Sandler, like, oeuvre Rob Schmeigel was.
Yeah.
I salute him. Ron the fake mailman. There ain't no way he's a real mailman. You see that logo on his shirt and hat? He is pretending to be a mailman, and I'm here to expose it.
Oh, man.
Moon balloons? This is the first time I've ever heard that.
Oh, boy.
And probably the last.
So is there anything else that you need to talk about before we have our final big discussion? Because
I'm trying to think if I touched on everything. I would like to put I need to highlight it because it's something that worked for me, especially because we see the basketball game in the opening scene. Mm-hmm. Like the reactions from their crewmates are awful, right? Like they are ignorant. They're homophobic. The fact that they circulate that petition to get them both transferred out of the station is ridiculous. But that rationalization, that first rationalization when Chuck's like, oh, what, you don't want to play with me? And they're like, well, you've always kind of been a physical player, and that was fine before we knew that you were a homosexual. And that recontextualized everything for us. Like, that's way smarter writing than was necessary in that moment.
Yeah, it could have been smarter, but yeah, sure.
Like, it's just, it's one of those things that, like, the first time I'm like, oh, fuck these guys, but then I'm like, no, I mean, like, they at least put some thought into it. It's not just them, like, saying, oh, no, you're this, you're that. You know, they're not dropping the pejoratives in that moment.
For
so.
Sure. The larger part for me is the oeuvre of that moment is this idea that, well, you're gay, so you must be into me is such a fucking stupid,
yeah, that's
like,
the
logic.
Most fucked up thing. Yeah. I do not, like, disagree with that at all. And
I
this
mean, the
film...
same reason why I think that, like, they should be able to play basketball with a woman, right? Is like, right. Like, they should be able to do that. Like, what are they worried
exactly
about?
Like, but I do like that the film, because in that moment, and essentially, I mean, because for better or for ill, the crew members have a bit of a character arc in that moment.
Yeah.
And because Chuck immediately defends them when she, like, first of all, it's weird that Jessica Biel's like, I can't believe those Italian stereotype nickname was so mean to you and wouldn't play basketball with you. Like, are you really an advocate right here? Or do you just have hate in a different way for these types of people? Like, it's like every time the movie, like, almost goes to a point, it also, like, makes sure that we're also grounded in the fact that not everything is great. I want to make sure that you know that.
Yeah, I believe one critic, I think, like, the New York Times, when I was reading through, said it best, is that this movie is phenomenal at taking one step forward and three steps back.
Yeah, like, it's like ridiculous. And Chuck's whole thing is like, no, they're not bad guys. They just need to adjust to it. They need time to work it through. And, like, he's not wrong with that. And so much in this world, and this film is guilty of that, we imagine that because something changes in your life, it's supposed to flip a switch and you're supposed to be completely all right with that change.
Yep.
If you have any time to have to adjust to a change in your life, you're kind of vilified for that. Like, yeah. Oh, you're not woke enough. But, like, that's just not how it works, right? The point of life in our world, at least in our society, is change. Change is an inevitable thing, and it's how we react to changes that ultimately determines the type of person that we are. So, like, the fact that they eventually get to that point where they're like, no, you're still the same people. It just took us a little bit longer to get to that. Like, that's almost more real than just, like, immediate acceptance.
No, for sure. But I mean, that doesn't mean that like Chuck and Larry should have to put their feelings on hold for two weeks.
That's the thing. We all are allowed those flaws that make us human. Right?
Yeah.
The fact that we have knee-jerk reactions, or the fact that, like, it's going to take me a little bit of time to understand it, but understand that I'm okay with it, but, you know, I might pause and I might slip up with your pronouns, and I'm sorry about that, but know that I support you, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's just, it's a really interesting thing that this film does highlight, and I support it for that. And I guess,
it's almost like the point of this movie was to spark conversation about gay marriage, and it does that, despite the fact that it doesn't handle it well.
Yeah.
So, like, is it a good movie because it does what it sets out to do, or is it not a good movie but it still achieves what it set out to do? Like, it's a weird thought process.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like, I'm very comfortable saying that this is not a good movie, and that if you don't ever want to watch this movie, don't.
Right,
like that's where I land.
Yeah, I don't think this is what. There are a lot of the Adam Sandler films where I'm like, yeah, you should definitely check this one out. My parents are gonna watch Blended over the next week, because I'm like, you guys really should see it. I think it's one that's maybe worth watching at least once in your life. But I don't think I would have that same discussion about I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. And then the final thing that I would like to say is Adam Sandler anti-weed in 2007? Like that Mr. Pickles scene where the guy, like him almost burning down the shack with his joint. That's a problem. You should know how to smoke a joint without almost burning down a building. That's just joint smoking 101. But then, like, him hitting that kid with the fire extinguisher, it sent me very mixed messages from a guy who 7 years earlier, they ate pot brownies and had a whole moment.
No, because I, like, the narc thing to do would have been to, like, turn him over to the police, because obviously police would be on the scene.
There are police on the scene when the kid's like, that's my Jay.
Yeah, but he doesn't do that, right?
Yeah.
Like he doesn't turn around and be like, arrest that guy. Like, he gives the kid shit, and like he fucks with a stoner with a kid that is so stoned at work that he burnt the building down. So like, I'm okay with him giving that kid some shit because that was just stupid. Like, I don't think that makes me anti-weed.
No. Actually, now that you've put it into that term, I think that's sort of the central like thesis of this film, all put together in one nifty moment, just because I'm going to call out the fact that you're an idiot for bringing attention to this thing that everybody should be okay with doesn't mean that I'm anti this thing, right?
Yeah.
I like smoking weed, but if you're going to get so high that you almost burn down buildings, you're going to ruin it for everybody.
Yeah, that's essentially what's going on in that moment.
All right, so the big moment, the discussion and the application of I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry against our laws of the ASCU. And that big question, does this film exist in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe, Seedrum?
I mean, I kind of feel that it does. It hits a lot of the sweet spots for me. It's not one where I feel like it is a shoo-in. So, like, there's definitely elements of it that make it look like it can fit. But, you know, like, there's hard evidence stuff of things like the book and things like that. But there's also the people that are there, the emphasis on family, the character arc that his character has, where he does become a better person by the end. And he is a little broken in the beginning, but it's not like it's not an obvious break. So that's maybe one knock against it, right? Like it's a weird one for me to just plug in immediately, but it feels like it fits for me.
This is, I have to admit, this is definitely a film in the ASCU. That's how I wrote it in my notes, and that is where I am. It's not that it's begrudging. It's just one of those things where, like, yeah, he's our crazy drunk uncle, and he's definitely part of the family. Like, we share some of the same blood with him. He's not only here through marriage.
Right.
Because it does. It has so much DNA of what the Adam Sandler cinematic universe is. Actually, the biggest knock that I might have against it is the fact that Adam is not the main character in this film. He is really playing second fiddle to Larry Valentine, played by Kevin James.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, and not only because of the fact that, like, Larry is sort of the main protagonist of this particular film, but I also think that it's a conscious choice because Kevin James, after being in a movie like Hitch, he's the person that people are going to go see a romantic comedy with.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's a smart move. And like I can definitely say that that's something we should examine, but I think if we start saying that in order to be a movie within that universe, Sandler has to be the main character, then there's an entire slew of Happy Madison films that we just don't look at, and I don't think that that's fair, because
no.
I bet you there's some stuff that we can find in some movies. Like I don't think this is the last time Kevin James as the starring character is going to be talked about on this podcast.
Oh, I don't either, but that's why I think it's an important thing to discuss in this moment.
Yeah, I think it's almost
like commandment worthy is the fact that just because Adam Sandler might not be the main character doesn't mean it can't slot into the ASCU.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's good that we establish that now, because I don't want to. That doesn't feel strong enough here to make the argument for this movie alone. And on top of that, the implications going forward are ridiculous, because that means that there's just an entire slew of films in the Happy Madison production that we would never look at, and they must, one or two of them must be in this world.
There's an entire slew of pre Billy Madison films.
Mm-hmm.
That would be eliminated that I'm fairly certain exist in this universe. And I can't wait to get to those as well. But yeah, it's in there. And not just because of the puppy that lost its way, but because of the sensibilities, because of the found family, right?
Mm-hmm.
You throw one of us, not just between Chuck and Larry, but also their firefighting brethren, right?
Yep.
The fact that they all do say, "I am Spartacus," and admit that they're part of it. The fact that they're all at that wedding between Kevin and Fred at the end of this movie, right?
And I could definitely see Eric recruiting Cliff there.
Clint Fitzer?
Yeah, Clint Fitzer to be in his, right?
Yo, yes. Eric Gordon is totally saying, "I need your investigative skills, because you're willing to go there.
And your bureaucratic bullshit knowledge."
Yeah. You are a worthy member of this league. In fact, I could almost see Clint Fitzer being Eric Gordon's right-hand man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, disposable right hand man. But
every right hand man is disposable. The best right hand man is disposable, which is why Starscream hates Megatron so much, because he knows he's not gonna stand for it.
Man,
but yeah, it's in there, and I see Clint there. I totally see Chuck Levine joining up with the hero thing, bringing in his sensibilities, wielding his cane with power and fear against the villains, and you know, maybe educating people along the way. I learned a lesson in 2007, and I think I can teach a lesson here today. We're actually good, Chuck. No. Let me finish talking.
Oh shit, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it works. I think it fits.
I agree. I'm happy that this film that, you know, is sort of universally reviled for reasons that we've brought up, and you know, it's not that it aged particularly poorly. It wasn't great at the time, because it was from a different time. It was from the gay panic of the 90s. Like that's so influential to this script that like to ignore that fact, it makes it weird that that type of movie came out in 2007. Like, but I guess, well, Adam Sandler's doing it. And Adam Sandler is the one who's like, "I really want to do this movie." Like, that's the other thing, is that he got the script and he said, "Let's do it." But when this was originally being shopped around with like Nicolas Cage and Will Smith, that was a very different Hollywood. Very different Hollywood. But yes, that's it. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. Welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, where I'm actually kind of happy to have you, because for all of those moments that are just, you have some moments that really do tug at my heartstrings.
For sure, Def.
Yeah. All right. Which brings us to, I guess, your homework for next month and our homework for next month, which is It's Spanglish. We already mentioned it before, but we're bringing some Tia Leone into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast.
Because that's what it was really missing.
I mean, you know what, Sijin? You joke and you laugh. I fucking love Tia Leone.
Yet you've never seen You Kill Me. It's fine. It's okay.
I'm sorry I've never seen You Kill Me. How many seasons of The Naked Truth have you watched?
I don't propose to be a Tay Leone fan, so I'm not saying I'm not a fan. I'm just saying that I'm not the one that said that just now.
That's true. I missed one of her movies. I'm sorry. I watched all 5 seasons of Madam Secretary, and I think I might start it up again. God, Madam Secretary is so good. But yeah, so it's Spanglish next month. We probably should have saved this one for Valentine's. I mean, there's a character named Valentine in it, but if you're gonna look at the Adam Sandler villains, you kind of have to start with I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry.
Yep.
It wouldn't feel right to start anywhere else. And, you know, if you're going to be digging into I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, what better time than on the heels of 8 Crazy Nights? Right?
There you go.
All right. So anything else you'd like to add to this one, Sijin, before we...
No, I'm excited for next month, and I'm glad to be back.
Yes, I am very happy to be back, too. I hope you guys are ahead to do it. If you have anything that you want to say to Sijin about his feelings on I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, or you have any other villain Adam Sandler films that you want to, you know, pass past our eyes, he is available at Siege Versus the World.
And if you want to give Devin any more crap for Tay Leone projects he hasn't taken part in, you can catch him at Devin D. Decker.
Yes, please do, because I need it from someone besides Sijin. It's really starting to affect my self-esteem. If you've enjoyed us talking about a focus topic like Adam Sandler, you can come find us every week. Every Monday we drop an episode of The Say Report. That's our other project. And we talk about everything there. So if you're like sick of us like harping on the Adam Sandler thing, there are other alternatives out there. And we'd love to hear you listen there as well. And that's The Say Report. But until next time, please just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.